Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the world of insects with entomologist Phil Pelletieri. Back once again, I know we'll talk about bees and wasps and other bug questions as well that you might have. And I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Phil Pelletieri, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
Been a very dry year so far. How does the drought affect insects? I know I've had almost no mosquito bites, for example.
Yeah, that was kind of easy to predict. Excuse me. There's just been no flooding. There's no standing water to speak of anything. Things are going the other direction. And so it really reduces habitat, and the result is no mosquitoes. But what I observed over my career is that we get a couple of these dry years, and when we get back to normal mosquitoes, people are going to be very disappointed.
Well, what about the rest of the insect world? How are they affected by the drought?
Well, you know, there's always things that benefit and things that don't. I'm getting to the point now of thinking back in my career. Back in 1988, we had a significant drought in the state, and I saw things I had never seen before. And so I'm kind of gearing up, you know, if this continues. Spider mites are the number one pest of everything in California because of the dry climate. And that's what I saw in 88. We had spider mites on plants that I just never saw before. Other things like box elder bugs are normally controlled by a fungus disease that requires some moisture and humidity. And so generally in the dry years, in the fall, we get overrun with box elder bugs. And there's a few other true bugs, false chinch bugs, regular chinch bugs that kind of work the same way. They really thrive under dry conditions. And we're getting to the point now that I suspect that they're going to probably have a pretty good year.
Hornets and yellow jackets are busy building nests. Maybe talk about the differences between wasps, hornets, and yellow jackets.
Well, you know, honestly, with some species, the terms are interchangeable in the entomological world. Of course, we use scientific names, so we know exactly the beast we're talking about. The yellow jackets, or, you know, technically, they are a type of wasp. Overwinter as queens, and those queens establish the nest in the spring. So the first ones you see are the queens looking for their habitat, and sometimes it's in the ground, sometimes they construct these paper nests and the like. And as the summer goes, the colony number builds. We're still at the point that the numbers are extremely low. It really is well into July before you kind of see this explosion. But the point is that if you know where they are now, they're much easier to deal with because you're dealing with, you know, handfuls of individuals at best. So if you see critters going in the ground, it'd be worth filling that hole up so that you're basically cutting off the nest before it's a chance to get very big. Same thing if critters are going underneath your siding, it's best to treat them now and much easier than if you wait a month or two from now.
Kind of relating to this, Jay emailed that he has a new shed, and it was obvious that it was a great place for wasps to construct their nests under the 6-inch overhang. Sure enough, it started happening almost immediately. He sprayed the initial set of 10 to 20 very small nests. Is there any kind of deterrent, or does he need to just remain diligent with the chemicals? Does the spray have any residual effect to keep them away?
Yeah, only for a few days at best. Now, on the other hand, all but one species that I can think of pretty much has to get established by now or it's not going to happen. The European paper wasp that has been in the state now for probably about 15 years or so is capable of establishing nests well into the summer. But the normal ones, usually if you can head them off at the pass early, you're okay. The only other thing, you know, for people who don't want to use chemicals, it gets kind of difficult. But, at times people have used variations of bird netting when birds are getting places you don't want. Well, the same thing is a light screening underneath the overhang might provide enough of a barrier to prevent them from doing that. So, that is one option. But I think things should be pretty good now. As I said, if you start getting in the first, second week of June, I don't expect much in the way of new establishment of nests.
Let's take a call. David in Minocqua, what's on your mind?
I had an unusual situation. I had I would, for example, go to bed at night and wake up in the morning and have a red blotch on my body somewhere, my skin somewhere, that looked like a mosquito bite. Wasn't a mosquito bite, and it kept happening with some frequency. And I was wondering, how is anything getting to me in bed at night? So I had an exterminator come over. He sprayed everything around the baseboards and the furniture and the mattresses. And well, it got better, but I still had it happen once or twice since then. And I went to a dermatologist, and he said, well, we can't figure out whether it's an insect bite. He took pictures from the physician's office and sent them over. And then maybe it's an insect bite, maybe it's a skin condition. And I was wondering, could it be an insect? I was wondering if it could be a spider or something that had been getting to me under me covers and or whatnot. Sure. I mean, it's a mystery altogether.
Yeah. You know, and the physician, you know, it's kind of the dilemma is bites and other reactions look so similar. What I often would suggest in this kind of case is to be a little bit of a detective. And what probably works as good as anything is they call them glue boards, and they're basically just a piece of sticky cardboard.
That's right. I read it about it.
And so put them, you know, by your window, because that's one place that critters could be coming and going. You know, you got to be a little careful. You got pets because you don't want the pets to get in the glue boards. But the whole idea is, if you catch something, you got something to react to. If we catch nothing, then you start to be suspicious. It's more some kind of skin reaction to some other kind of irritant. And the thing about spiders is, it really is quite unusual. Spiders get blamed for a whole lot of things they don't do. Most of them are not capable of biting because the way their fangs are structured. The ones that do bite, you often will get a double puncture mark. But what would be quite unusual is repeat bites from spiders. I mean, that's just not what they're about. And so, you know, in the scheme of things, bird mites, although it's seasonal, is something that I sometimes see. If there's a bird nest outside the window, the mites migrate in and cause irritations. Although more often than not, those bites present a little more like blisters than traditional bites. You know, of course, bed bugs is a possibility, but bed bugs are both easily seen by somebody who's used to looking for them, and you would expect things to get progressively much worse over time. Now, you know, you do get weird situations where mosquitoes come indoors and bother folks, but again, it's kind of a, you know, you had some bad luck, one got indoors. You wouldn't expect this repeat, you know, over a period of days or weeks, repeat bites from things unless there was a constant source. And that's where I go back to the bird mite thing. The other thing I'll warn you, though, about bird mites, you got to be careful on the internet because, boy, there is some sites that give a lot of false information, like once you get them, you can never get rid of them. Where, to be honest, the reality is if you find the bird nest and get rid of the bird nest, you're done with them. So, I think I would use the glue boards just to see if you can get more evidence to point you in a direction.
Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in to 800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. Joe emailed and sent quite a beautiful photo. He was on a camping trip in Northern Highland American Legion State Forest. And he watched several dragonflies floating on the water and vibrating. Any idea what this behavior is about? He sent along a photo that I have in front of me. It's this beautiful shot of
right.
And you have it in front of you, Phil, as well.
Yeah, I'm a bit perplexed. So, you know, without seeing the photo with just the background, I thought, you know, he's probably observing his dragonflies inserting their eggs in the water. But the problem with that theory is that the abdomen should be going the other direction. You know, you see dragonflies pointing their abdomen in because they're dropping eggs or sometimes injecting them into plants. It just depends on the species. And looking at this picture, my first thought is this is not very smart for the dragonfly to do because those vibrations will attract fish. And so you're kind of a sitting duck. So I don't know if the dragonflies have kind of run out of energy and have just sat there, but I don't think this is a good behavior. And I'm not a dragonfly expert, but I have not seen this. And as I said, my first take looking at it would suggest that this is not good for the dragonfly because it's definitely making it very susceptible to predation by fish and other things.
Yeah, absolutely. It's pretty, a pretty shot, though. Paul in Westby, your turn. Hi, Paul. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, yes, I was looking at my plants this, well, a couple weeks ago, and I noticed they were getting eaten. So I went out one night, and I noticed they were just literally covered with brown, you know, the little brown beetles, the June bugs. I mean, I had thousands of them. So I sprayed that night, and the next day I came out and I picked up 2.5 gallons of bugs because I didn't want the birds and other rodents eating them anymore. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to know, is this unusual, or is there anything I can do about it for next year?
Okay, so the big question, was this trees that they were picking on or other things?
They were picking on my blueberry bushes. They were some on the rhubarb. They were on some filbert bushes and some cauliflower plants.
Wow, interesting. So, you know, we have a number of species of true June beetles in the state, and certain years you get big populations of adults, and what this is important for is your lawn, because the year or 2 years after they show up, potentially you've got more grubs in your lawn. Doesn't mean it's going to happen, but there's that relationship. And then you can go the next year, you see no adults, and but primarily because they're flying at night. It's common to fly at night and then to be kind of hard to find during the day. But most of the defoliation that I have seen in my career has been on trees, oak trees, birch trees, and the like. Now, the blueberries and the filberts make some sense. The woodies, the cauliflower doesn't. I don't know if I've ever seen them feed on anything in the crucifer family. But the point is that, you know, there can be a two-week, maybe three-week at most, flight period, and then they're gone. So if you're not seeing them bumping around on your night lights and whatnot, and we're getting late enough now, I would think we're at the end of it if it hasn't already happened. You got nothing more to worry about as far as, but those are staggering numbers. And it's been a long time since I've gotten those kind of reports. You know, again, I go back to when I was a kid, we seemed to see a whole lot more June beetles out there than we do now. And I don't know what all that dynamic is about, but in the years that you get these tremendous adult populations, you do see defoliation. And again, often it could be a 40-foot oak tree that they come in and almost totally strip, but then those trees come back. So, yeah, I the only thing I'd be a little cautious of is what might happen to your lawn next year. Now, we started the show talking about the dryness. The dryness is going to make it real tough on the grubs. Because, you know, if the females lay their eggs in the soil and they hatch into basically dry soil, they're not going to do so well. So that may prevent that from happening. But just be careful. It wouldn't hurt either this fall or next spring just to cut a small piece of sod and roll it back and just see how many grubs you see. If you see a couple per square foot, I'm not nervous. You start seeing 10 or 12 per square foot, then I am. And then, of course, you can always just roll this stuff back. But this would allow you to treat next spring or early summer to prevent your lawn from getting tore up. Another sign of a lot of grubs in the lawn often is in the fall of the year, either raccoons or skunks come in and start tearing the lawn up because there's so much grubs there for them to feed on. And that sometimes is the first sign that people have got. And if you backtrack, it's often a year or, again, maybe 2 years after this big adult flight that phenomena happens.
Paul, thank you again for calling. Appreciate it. Let's see. Oh, here's another Paul in Iron County. Hi, Paul.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Long-time listener, first-time caller. I had a question on the Japanese beetles. Last couple of years, they haven't been too bad, but I remember 15, 16 years ago, we have a place on Sherwood Road down in Madison, Wisconsin, and we had a big problem with them. And it just hasn't seemed to be that bad the last couple of years, and I'm just wondering if the drought's going to take those numbers down even further. I don't want them feasting on my basil.
Okay, I understand that. So I recognize the voice, and I'll warn you, Paul, that there's a turkey with five poults heading down towards your garden, but I'll leave that be for now. But your question, it's been well documented in Madison an unbelievable decrease. I mean, 95% decrease in the population of Japanese beetles on the west side of Madison.
since it first established about 15, 16 years ago. And this data comes from a person over in soil science that has a Japanese beetle trap, and he counts the beetles that he catches. He's got it all figured out how much they weigh. So he's got a number of years' data, and what you watched is this repeated drop in population, which we diseases and those kind of things than anything else. So more of a natural balance. But then you throw on top of it a drought like this, this will have an effect, but it's not time yet. The Japanese beetles will lay their eggs in July and early August, and then it depends what the conditions are in the lawns at that time. If they're dry, they don't do well. If they're lush, they do very well. For that reason, where Japanese beetles always seem to do reasonably well, it's golf courses because they're always irrigated, so they don't have that variable. But again, Paul and I live a block from a golf course, and most of our misery was from beetles that migrated from the golf course to our homes. And even with those conditions, as I said, the population has dropped to the point that, I mean, we still see them, but it's like a different universe compared to what we put up with 15 years ago.
Paul, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Well, Bill in Madison, we'll go to you now. Hi, Bill.
Hey. I have my whole raspberry crop was wiped out last year by a Desphelia fly is what it's called. My landlord was telling me they lay the eggs right about now. The eggs hatch as the berries start to ripen, and then they're little worms, and they suck all the sugar out of the berries. So basically the berries get not quite fully red, but they're just about there. Didn't touch my blackberries at all. He's got a mixture that sucks these in right now. We hung some little cups or so, little cans, and it's just loaded with these things. I never heard of that before. These, I think I'm saying that right, Desphelia fly?
Yeah, they're really Drosophila, and it is a fruit fly. This one is called the spotted wing fruit fly because it's the males have got a little black dot on their wings. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that the critters that you're catching are all spotted wing, because most of the fruit fly species we have, and there's well over 100 species in the U.S., breed on overly ripe fruit. And this is a Japanese species that's been in the state now for, oh boy, getting close to 10 years or so. And its claim to fame is it does lay its eggs before the berries even start to color. And that's the first problem, is that you don't know you've got a problem until you harvest your berries and you see these little white maggots come out and the whole problem. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're 2 weeks too late, you know, is the frustration. So typically once they get there, they seem to stay, meaning that they recur annually. And the defense is to be aggressive early. Again, when you just start to get berries forming, that's when you got to put the protection up. Although I'm a little curious, because typically – we would see most of the pressure coming on in July and August, so it's more the later bearing berries. We can get our strawberries through and some of our other early season fruits without a problem, which is a blessing compared to some of the other states where they have a much longer season. But I guess I would say from mid-June on, you do have to, if they've been in the area, consider spraying. And so, you know, that's where the disappointment becomes high maintenance. There are some organic sprays that can be used, but you're talking two, maybe three applications during the growing season to get the fruit through without having the maggots in there. And it's again, been kind of a learning curve for all of us, because it's a new critter to the United States, but it was interesting to see from its first discovery, it had spread to every state in the United States within 3 years.
Wow. Bill, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, entomologist and a distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Tyler Ditter, our engineer. Jill Nadeau, our producer. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri. Great to have him back. You can join in with your questions. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. And Peter in Eden emailed that while golfing and hitting out of a sand trap, he inadvertently hit into a nest, found himself in a swarm of wasps or bees. He was able to run away and only got one sting on his forearm, which proved to be almost as painful as the short putt he missed soon after. he's wondering, were they wasps or were they bees or what were they?
Okay, I think it's a ground nesting yellow jacket from that behavior of lots of them coming out. And, you know, they're using old rodent burrows and other pre-existing holes, and they are constructing a paper wasp-like nest in the ground. And the problem is if that nest is disturbed, and I'm a little surprised the golf course people didn't have problems when they're mowing and whatnot. Now, they may be doing
well,
it early enough.
This is in the sand trap.
Right. But right on the edge, you know, if I'm guessing, it was probably close to the edge because that interface is where I might expect gophers or other things to dig holes and the like. And you know, when we're dealing with wasps, you know, the biggest question I ask is it a species that has an individual nest with just one individual, or do they live in colonies? And the reality is the ones that live in single nests are very non-aggressive. They really don't defend things. In fact, some of them can't even sting. But the ones that live in colonies are the ones that we have the biggest problem with, where you can get multiple stings. And wasps do not have barbs on their stingers, so an individual wasp is capable of stinging you as many times as it can. So you can get a number of, quote, stings from even just one, let alone this frenzy they go into when they're disturbed and the like. So as we talked about earlier, the later we get in the season, the more of a concern it is, and usually it's at least the 1st of August, if not later, before we experience the biggest problem with them being aggressive. That being said, again, going back to where we sit with the climate right now, in very warm years, everything happens earlier. So I have seen wasps be a problem in the very end of July in the hottest of seasons. In the coolest of seasons, sometimes they don't even start to be an issue into September. So again, let's watch what happens in the next 6 weeks with the weather. But much like we talked about, the dry weather will influence things. If it stays as warm as it has been consistently, expect everything to move up a little bit as far as their activity patterns.
Helen in Little Chute, thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Hello. I'm 70 years old, and I've lived in different parts of the country. And this spring, I allowed my door to be open for about 15 minutes. I was trying to get some fresh air into my home. And unfortunately, a couple of crickets got in, and they've been with me for about 10 weeks. One went down the basement, which was right by the front door, and the other one is right in my entranceway. Is there any way I can get rid of these critters? They're, you know, annoying.
Right. Well, the good news, so if the crickets were chirping early, we've got two kinds of crickets. We got those that spend the winter as half-grown crickets and start singing in the spring. But the good news about those guys is they die out by the time we get in the midsummer. And then when you think about the other crickets in the late summer and fall, the other thing, they hatch from eggs and then mature. And it's only mature crickets that aren't making the noise. So a couple thoughts. They're tough to get to because they're often hiding in places. You know, and if you told me it was underneath your door stoop, I'd say, you know, just get some ant spray and spray in any little crack you can see, and that would be a chance of getting it. I'm fearful that the one that's down in the basement, it's going to be harder to see. One of the other things that can be used, especially, again, for people that don't prefer not to spray, you can try some of these glue boards, again, placed in places. And, you know, where that works is something like, let's say you had a chest freezer downstairs and the darn cricket was making noise underneath that. Putting one of these glue boards under there is often, when they're crawling around, they get caught in it, and it acts as a trap, if you think of it that way. But, again, because it's the spring type of species, I'm thinking things are going to quiet down. It might be another week or two, but I don't expect them to live through the whole summer because, as I said, their biology is such that they should be maturing and dying out before we get too much longer.
Helen, thank you so much. Tom in Amherst, we'll go to you now. Hi, Tom. Oh, I'm sorry. What is it? It's Tom. Terry in Amherst. Let's go to you. Sorry.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you for calling.
Thank you very much. I was responding to the gentleman on the filberts. I have four new hazelnut bushes I put in this spring. The three striped potato bugs are covering them and completely devastated one of them, and I got three left that I can't keep up hour by hour of picking them off. I tried insecticidal soap, mm-hmm. and that didn't seem to do much. I'm wondering if I can use some neem oil on them. And
yeah, neem will be a little better, although it still would not be my first choice. The problem with the insecticidal soap is it works well on critters that are soft-bodied, but beetles are built like little tanks, and the soap never gets into their body to do the disruption that's needed. If you're looking for an organic spray, there is a product that's been now on the market for probably about 10 years. I know it under the name Spinosad, S-P-I-N-O-S-A-D. It's in various organic sprays like Dr. Jack's Dead Bug Brew, and there's other ones. There's a number of small packagers. But the thing about that product, it's very good on worms, and it's very good on beetles. And one spray should give you probably about 4 to 5 days worth of residual. That will be a way of protecting the plants. The other thing is, I think this is going to be somewhat seasonal. The leaf beetles that come out in the spring aren't going to be there all summer. It's unfortunate because, again, new plants you want to be able to grow without being disturbed. But they should be able to survive as long as you keep them watered and other things. It'll just slow their growth a little bit. But as I said, I would consider the Spinosad product. You can try the neem. Neem is a little bit hot and cold in the sense that unless you have experience, it's somewhat hard to predict. It works against some beetles and not others, has been my experience. And so I'm a little hesitant, whereas I know the Spinosad product would work against this type of beetle.
All right, Terry, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Dave in Plymouth, on to you now. Hi, Dave.
Good, thank you. I enjoy your program.
Thank you.
Now, in the past couple years, I have set Japanese traps just to keep them out of the garden. Now, my wife says that setting traps is drawing the beetles from my neighbor's yard. So we get a lot of them. So am I better off not setting the traps and just spraying, or what do you think?
Yes. Japanese beetle has been an issue now in the United States for over 100 years. And so a lot of states have done a lot of research before those stinkers ever showed up here. And basically, unless you have an extremely large lot where you can put the traps a good distance away from your garden, what the research had suggested is that you draw more beetles in, because you don't catch all the beetles you draw in. The ones you don't catch will eat your plants. And so there's a joke among entomologists, you buy traps for your neighbors. But the reality is, as I said, unless you've got some very special conditions, you're probably better off to not use the traps and then just react to what you see. A couple beetles is no big deal. If they're overrunning certain plants, then it's worth treating. And the other thing, again, my friend Paul, who had called, reminded me of my wars with Japanese beetle. And one of the things that I had witnessed when we were getting these beetles migrating from the golf course a block down the road is if I got out there and sprayed my potentillas when they first showed up, they went away, at least for those plants. Unfortunately, they showed up on my neighbor's cotonia aster and continued. So what we know is that when they get on a plant, they attract more. And sometimes if the numbers aren't too high and you can stop them very early, they go find something else to feed on down the road and it will leave you alone. So, when the numbers are incredibly high, that's not going to be enough. But as I said, I did experience that if I could kind of shut the door early, they would leave it around. And there was a couple, 3 years, I never saw a yellow flower on my potentilla. They'd eat them as soon as they pop. But now they're, of course, it's a little early, but it's not the issue. And this seems to be the pattern that I saw during my career, that Japanese beetles got into an area, started to build, got crazy within the first 5 or 6 years, and then really over time settled down. And so I hope
that continues. I really don't know of any cases. Usually if we start hearing of another flare-up, there's been a change in the environment, like a new development with a lot of sodded, irrigated lawns, which would be ideal places for them to breed.
Dave, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Let's turn to Patty in Eden next. Hi, Patty.
Hi. Good to hear you again, Phil. It's always so educational about insects. I have a bunch of gypsy moths everywhere, and I have no idea how to keep them under control or get rid of them. Any suggestions?
So right now, what I'm guessing, you got big caterpillars crawling around the yard?
Yeah, well, they're not quite as adult size yet, but they're starting to they kind of get bigger as they emerge or whatever.
Yeah. Well, see, and, the thing about gypsy moth, and this is the one that I'm glad you brought up, because when gypsy moth first got here, we watched it spread. And what we really never saw is things get quite as crazy as they did out east. And the reason for it is a fungus disease. And the one problem I have with this dry weather is the fungus disease isn't going to work. Now, in order to get a big population build, you need two or three dry springs in a row. And this is probably the first one. Last year was pretty wet. So what I'm saying is I'm getting nervous about next spring, if it stays dry, that we're going to see an explosion. But for you right now, you're almost to the point. We're far enough along that the gypsy moths are going to start to mature, turn into adults, which means the feeding stops. And so you're not going to see a whole lot more damage, maybe another week at best. And it's almost the argument that it's late enough now that it really doesn't solve any problems for you. And again, what you look for is what's going to go on. And you know, what gypsy moths will do is the moths, interesting enough, the females can't fly. So they pretty much can't go very far from where the caterpillars spin their cocoons down. And they construct this egg mass, and usually you see it on the trunks of trees and sometimes on the side of your house and the like. And those egg masses can be scraped off. They can be sprayed with oils and the like if there's a bunch of them. The other thing to me is you see a bunch of egg masses on your trunks, you know you're going to potentially have problems the following spring. But the proper time, if you were going to treat them on trees, is usually early to mid-May. So it's really much earlier. We want to shut the door when the caterpillars are really small and before they really get going. So I said, for now, I'm not sure. If you had one particular plant that they seem to be picking on, and you could use almost any garden insecticide to knock them down. There's even a bacterial insecticide that can be used. But as I said, I'm guessing we're far enough along. You're not going to gain much with that. And my biggest concern would be more if we could crystal ball and see where the weather is. If we get a normal wet spring, the fungus disease will kick in and help keep the lid on the population. But as I said, when I think of two or three dry springs in a row, I start to get nervous because those are the conditions that allow them to get absolutely crazy.
Patty, thank you so much. Aaron emailed that last year the stink bugs were swarming on the siding and windows of his home, while his neighbors' homes were hardly affected. What attracts stink bugs to a home besides, sheltering for winter? Can his house be treated?
The only thing that I can think of, and this goes from other fall-invading insects, the Asian lady beetle and cluster flies and the like, is there seems to be a visual sun effect. In that most of these fall invading insects congregate during the mornings in afternoons. And the difference may be that the sun is hitting his siding, which is drawing them there, and his neighbor, the way it's facing, may be shaded just enough that you don't see that. So that would be a phenomena that might explain what's going on here. I don't know of a whole lot of color stuff. I said most of the research that I saw done was with Asian lady beetle and its attractant, and it was really dynamic, the differences in fact, the higher the contrast. So if you think about the sun coming down and hitting your overhang, there's a dark shaded area, and then where the sun hits, that interface seems to be the strongest attracting of what's going on. And so the people that were having the worst problems are these beautiful homes that have a nice southern exposure up on a hill to look over the valley. When you think about when the sun hits it, it's just, I mean, you can be drawing things away from hundreds of yards or even a half a mile away or more.
Okay. Well, let's see. We've got Kathleen in Minocqua up next. Hi, Kathleen.
Good morning, Larry, and thank you for taking my call. And sure. Phil, I'm a fan of yours. I always look forward to your appearance on the show.
Thank you.
I, for the past 5 years, have had a problem with black ants. Now, at first, it was just a little annoyance, but it keeps growing every year in my yard, and it's gotten to the point where I can hardly turn over a rock without finding a colony of black ants. And I've tried every commercial product that I can find, and it doesn't seem to phase them. And I tried borax, and that worked pretty well, except they just move from one place to another, it seems like. And I'm just not that comfortable putting down so much borax. And so I just would like to know if you have any ideas of what I can do.
Right. Yeah, the borax, it's interesting. They use boric acid in ant baits, but in order for it to really be effective, it has to be ingested. It has to be eaten. And just using borax by itself, they don't eat much of it because there's no reason to eat it. And, of course, you get too many borates in an area, it has some plant issues and the like. So what I'm not sure of is you may have more than one species of ant. The ant that causes the biggest problem outdoors, makes the big nests and you find under rocks and whatnot, are called field ants. And although they are among the larger ants in the state, it's an ant that just doesn't come indoors. It's not interested in people food for the most part. Whereas the other ant that looks almost identical, that can be found even nesting indoors, are carpenter ants. Now, typically, they nest in rotting wood, in stumps, in those kind of environments. And sometimes if you get the right environment, they'll nest in wood and, you know, like window frames and stuff in the house. So, you know, from what you're describing, I think it's more of a field ant problem. And what goes on there is that there is a single queen that lives for 10 to 12 years. And so the colonies can continue to grow and really be quite large. So we've got some species that will make a nest, you know, 10 inches high and 3 feet wide, and they'll kick up so much soil that they'll literally kill the plants around them. But the secret to controlling that colony is to kill the queen, and she's down in the ground. And so anything you do on the surface, I don't expect to work very well. And so what you have to consider is getting whatever your product of choice is down to the queen. And what I typically use is a wooden pole or a steel rod, and when you go up to the colony, or again, you lift a rock and it's full of ants, I push and make 3 or 4 channels down deep so that I'm getting down to where the ants are really breeding and where the queen is expected to be found. And then whatever my product of choice, and there are lots of ant products out there, I mix it in a bucket of water according to the label directions and just pour it down those holes so that it goes deep where it does the most good. And then, you know, you can literally cap it with untreated soil if you want to reduce the amount of pesticide that's exposed to the soil surface. And then you're going to be, even though it's rather labor intensive, I think you're going to find it's going to be far more effective. Most chemicals repel ants. And so if you put chemicals on the surface of an ant nest, they stop being active and you say, oh, I got them. And then you come back a week later and they're active again. And all that's happened is that chemical, and it can even be something as innocent as mint oil or like that you put on it. The ants don't want to cross that barrier. They kind of lay low or avoid it until it's gone, and then they come back. So as I said, to me, the secret is getting whatever you choose down to where it will get to the queen. You know, most garden insecticides would be suitable, and the label would allow that type of use. So it's not like you have to buy something special. It's really how you use it will affect more how good the effect of the treatment will be.
Yeah, Kathleen, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist and a distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Phil Pelletieri, entomologist at and a distinguished faculty associate emeritus at the UW-Madison. Great to have Phil back. And the caller's online, and we've got some emails, so let's see what Marilyn emailed. She wants to encourage listeners to help bees by selecting or setting out low pans of water with a few stones in place for footing for the insects. She also has a hanging bird waterer that the bees are really using, the honeybees.
Yeah, so, you know, honeybees use the water to basically cool the hive. And so, again, under these drought conditions where it's hard to find water, and also the warm temperatures, it's probably even more important. I mean, we'd get the complaint sometimes if a neighbor had a honeybee colony, they'd come over to people's pools taking the water. So it is a good idea to provide water for them, and especially if you know you've got honeybees in the area, because as they said, they will use it, bring it back, and basically between their wing flapping and the evaporation, they cool the colony, which allows them to maintain the kind of temperatures they need to be able to raise their young.
Tracy in Madison, your turn. Hi, Tracy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have two different bugs in my yard that I have questions about. One is in the trees. It seems to be possibly spider mites because they're making webs and eating the ends of leaves. The other is on my asters, and I just discovered it yesterday. They're a kind of a small bug that crawls around on the leaves and is turning it all yellow. It's kind of covered in them, and they seem to have tiny little wings.
Okay, so the first one, let's go to the second one. I wonder if it's aphids, because it is quite common when you get colonies of aphids to get curling, yellowing, and then there are winged and non-winged forms of aphids. You know, that one will be interesting to watch, only in that typically what I tend to find is that aphids come under natural control. We often see the biggest aphid problems in the spring when the aphids are breeding and the things that eat them haven't caught up yet. But you can consider, you know, just even a forceful spray of water, or you can spray them with insecticidal soap just to knock the numbers down. But if you're starting to see wing forms and they're getting adults, I think they're starting to fly away rather. And the leaves that are injured, what my biggest concern would be on the new growth, if you're seeing them ganging up on the new growth and crippling that versus just on some older leaves and the plants will grow out of it. Now, the critters in that are causing the webbing, although spider mites can create webbing, you don't see critters. And when you get a bunch of leaves folded, it's got to be some kind of webworm, and there's a number of different webworms, but what webworms technically are caterpillars that turn into various species of moths. Sometimes you're lucky you just got one or two tents, as we call them, and you can prune them out. Or other times you can spray around there, but make sure that there's still critters there, because often what I would see is they'd kind of finish their feeding and move on, and that's when you discover the problem. So it's worth opening up, and you should see some little worms of one sort or another. Some of them are hairy, some of them are not. The thing about most webworm species is they're pretty specific in what they want to eat. So it's not like they will attack a wide variety of plants. They usually attack a very small group of plants and the like. And I'll say I saw very few true tent caterpillars this spring. And I'm not quite sure why that is, but you see their populations fluctuate. There's webworms on Euonymus and the like. There's also a fall webworm that starts to show up in July and August on a lot of our trees. So there's a number of different species, but that's the typical behavior of webworms, where a bunch of caterpillars live together in a colony, and they construct that little webbing as kind of a protected place.
Tracy, thank you very much. Kel in Sugar Camp, your turn. Hi, Kel.
Hi. It's always wonderful when Phil is on. I see this beautiful caterpillar every year, and I used to see it when I was a child when I grew up in Janesville. It's about 2 inches long. It's slender. It's bristly. It's got a dominant color, the slate, grayed blue. It has little black lines on either side of its spine, and then a little slate blue, and then a black line down its spine with these beautiful pale yellow ellipsoids, little tiny dots, but not round. And I see it every spring, and I was wondering if you might know what it was.
Yeah, my first guess, and it would be worth looking up on the Internet, is forest tent caterpillar. Now, eastern tent caterpillar makes a nest, and it has a distinct white, solid white line down the back. Forest tent caterpillar has this kind of broken, dotted appearance, and it's more of a yellowish pattern. It also has a nice, distinct blue and in black. And so I wonder, and forest tent caterpillar doesn't make a tent. And it really is not much of an issue in the southern part of the state. There are years that we do have big populations in the northern part of the state where there are outbreaks, and they'll strip all the aspens and a few other of the broadleafs. So to the point that, you know, it almost looks like a science fiction movie if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time. But as I said, we historically have not had any outbreaks of forest tent caterpillar in the southern half of the state or so. But I bet you that's what you see. And there's always some out there. It's just that usually their numbers are low enough that they're not of concern. But they are a very attractive critter if you tend to see them. And again, what confuses people is we call them tent caterpillars, so you expect to see a tent, but the forest tent species does not make a tent.
Cal, thank you so much. Appreciate it. John in Madison, your turn. Hi, John.
Yes, I have an area of my dead lawn that started very quickly last fall. In the spring, I had no grass whatsoever, and I could actually peel back the surface of the grass. And I thought at first it was grubs, and I peeled back the lawn and dug down, didn't find any grubs. I'm wondering if it's possibly cinch bugs instead of grubs.
Mm-hmm.
I've been able to reseed the area, and I have grass growing, and it's doing just fine, but I'm worried that it's going to happen again.
Yeah, the symptoms you described could be cinch bug related, but we haven't had the weather conditions. And typically, the one distinctive thing about cinch bug dead spots, it's the most exposed, hottest area of the lawn, any place that's shade. Cinch bugs don't like shade. And so, you know, you'll often see it very easy to find. But even that, it's not diagnostic, because cinch bugs do most of their feeding in the middle of July and August. So it's a middle summer, later summer problem. But if they kill the lawn off, of course, the next spring, there's nothing there. So I'm glad that you did the grub test, and I agree with you. There's no reason to believe it was grubs, because there should have been significant grubs there. And I just don't see grubs as a big issue in lawns in the southern part of the state. You know, I always tell people, it always concerned me that people were putting grub control on as a preventative, when the chance of having a significant grub problem is, you know, 1 in 1,000, as far as I'm concerned. And so you kind of have to react to it. Now, earlier we had that call that the gentleman had all the June beetles around. I'd be a little nervous in that situation if the, you know, situation or weather continues to be in favor of them. But here, it still could be disease, you know, because it causes very similar. I mean, grass is very hard to identify the damage unless you get your nose right down in there. And sometimes you get lucky. If you see the insects, okay, now I know I've got a culprit. You don't see anything. It's hard to put the pieces together. And as I said, what I tend to find is diseases tend to be often more of an issue, and sometimes hard to explain why. And diseases, unfortunately, are harder to manipulate than insects are. But I would just wonder, and I'm encouraged that everything is growing fine. If you keep things watered, it's not going to be a chinch bug problem. They will not thrive under that environment. Just like the box elder bugs, they get sick from a fungus disease if things are wet. But if things are very dry and we don't have that natural control, that's when they'll break out. And we will see chinch bugs. If this continues for another 4 or 5 weeks, we will see chinch bug damage in July and August in the southern part of the state.
Mm. John, thanks again. Scott in Madison, your turn. What's on your mind?
Morning. I'd like an identification. A spider about half to 5/8 of an inch long with a large white abdomen.
Any banding on the legs?
They're so fast I can't grab them without wrecking them, and I'm not going to hurt them.
Okay. In the abdomen, real bright white or more creamy?
It's a bright white.
Well, I'm a little suspicious, although, you know, it usually isn't totally bright white. It's more kind of a white striping and flecking. Fishing spiders, which are kind of related to wolf spiders. Because you describe how quick the little devils are, or big devils, it sounds like, that's characteristic of these hunting spiders like the wolf spiders and the fishing spiders. And the fishing spiders are sometimes very attractive. I mean, the contrast with the white in other dark parts on the body. So I look up on the internet at fishing spiders, you know, look at three or four pictures. As I said, they are a little bit variable in color, but that would be my first guess, especially this time of the year. You know, a lot of our more colorful spiders are more late summer and fall, and then I'd get into some, you know, orb weavers and the like. But I bet you it is either a fishing spider, or do look at wolf spiders too, because there are some pretty, what we call ornate, but colorful species there too.
Scott, thank you so much for calling. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, entomologist and a distinguished faculty associate emeritus. Great to have him with us. He'll be with us right up until 12:30. Today, so you'll be able to join in with your questions. You can call us at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. We'll take a look at the news and then we'll be back. I'm Larry Mailer for the Ideas Network. Larry Mailer here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. We're talking about insects with Phil Pelletieri, entomologist and a distinguished faculty associate emeritus. He retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab in 2014, and he comes by regularly to talk about insects with us. So if you have a question, call us at 800-642-1234 or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Phil Gary sent a photo of a wasp that is about 5 inches long from stem to stern here and wonders how that wasp uses its ovipositor.
Sure. He sent two pictures. We'll start with the first one, which is that wasp with the long egg-laying device. This critter attacks insects in wood. And it uses this to drill in the wood. It goes after something called a horntail, which is a wasp relative that lives in there, lays its eggs, and their grubs get into the horntail grubs and kill them. So it's very specific. And this, quote, stinger is absolutely harmless to people, but when you look at it, it looks like the scariest thing you've ever seen. Now, the other picture that Gary sent was a picture of a hornworm that literally has probably about 100 cocoons on the outside. This is also a parasitic wasp, but it's a different species. This one, I think, we call it a braconid, is the fancy name. Again, the wasp lays its egg in the caterpillar. What's absolutely amazing about this one is the wasp doesn't have to lay 100 eggs. It can lay one egg that will develop into hundreds of individuals, both male and female. So think about that. If you lay a egg, the insect, in some sense, is deciding what gender it's going to be, and it depends on how big the caterpillar. It's really quite complicated and very intriguing. But these are both examples of what is the natural problem that insects have, is these parasitic insects that help keep many of the pest species from getting out of control. And this is when we start talking about the importance of diversity, of having these kind of checks in the environment to prevent some of the pest species from getting out of control.
Yeah. And Lisa sent a photo as well. I don't know if you have that in front of you.
Yeah. So I did a little bit. You know, my first thought, it was one of two things, and I had to look carefully. So the first thing, this is a Dobson fly. And Dobson flies are upwards of 3 inches long. This appears to be a female. The males have extremely long, scary-looking but harmless jaws. Now, there's also something called a giant stonefly that looks very similar, but the wings are a little bit flatter. In both cases, these insects live in moving water, rivers and streams typically. The adults emerge. They do no feeding. They're very short-lived. But what I think happened here is this Dobson fly is hanging out, keeping away from the birds and other predators. They're usually more active at night. In fact, that's often what brings them into people's yards, is your security lighting and night lights draw them in. So it really kind of an interesting, as a lovely picture, it has nothing to do with the foxglove, but other than it's hanging out there. And as I said, they're really, really neat creatures. But I bet you there is a river or a fast-moving, pretty significant stream within a couple miles of the house or less.
Well, it looks like there might be a stream in the background of that photo, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
So, really cool photos for sure. Dan in Sun Prairie has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Dan.
Hello.
Dan, are you there?
No, this is Ken.
Oh, Ken in Sun Prairie?
Yeah, that's me.
Okay.
Yeah, I have an answer to the person with the ant problem. I have a 3/8 smooth rod, steel rod, sharpened the point on one end, and I just have a little ball of rags in my hand and a half a pint of gasoline. I push that rod as far as I can down that. Well, you have to find that entrance hole where they're coming and going. I push that as far as I can. It goes down about 1 foot. I pull that rod out, dump that gas in. My ants are gone. That's all I have.
Yeah, no, I believe you. It works. The problem is that the gasoline probably has more potential problems than any insecticide I can come up with. I know it's convenient, but typically, as I said, if you used a very dilute insecticide, there's far less issues, whereas gasoline tends to go places we don't want it to sometimes. But you hit it on the head. The importance is getting it down there.
Yeah, there we go. Ken, thanks. Steve in Oxford. Hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I was camping on islands out on the Wisconsin River just below the Castle Rock Dam. And saw two bugs there that I've not seen before. One was a butterfly, which apparently hatches all at the same time, because in spots, especially level areas, there was just where I would walk in and a blizzard of butterflies would rise up and bouncing off of me. And they were about the size of a quarter, maybe 50 cent piece, brown with white, little white spots on their wings and little bulbs on the end of their antennae. You know what those are?
Well, first thing, I think the phenomena you witnessed is something we call puddling. And a number of different species of butterflies will be attracted to small, sometimes it's not even standing water, but it's mud. And literally, they're picking up the salts out of the water, and that's what draws them in. Now, my first guess is the wood nymph. My second guess is a hackberry butterfly. And those both are it'd be worth looking up to see if it fits, because sometimes, you know, the way we describe things, I don't quite pick it up as well as I should. But it's one of those two species. I've seen hackberry butterflies all emerge at once and do this puddling phenomena. Less common in wood nymphs, but I wouldn't rule it out. I've also seen this phenomena with tortoiseshell butterflies. I've seen this phenomena with tiger swallowtails. I've seen this phenomena with at least a couple, three other species. So, as I said, I'm sure you witnessed some puddling. It's just a question of getting the species right. But I would look up under hackberry butterfly and also the wood nymphs. There's more than one wood nymph species, but they all kind of look the same. They're kind of brown with some pretty distinct creamy white spots on them. So,
all right. Steve, thanks. EJ, it's your turn next. In Phillips. Hi, EJ.
Hi. Thanks, Phil, for your continued information to help us understand insects. We live surrounded by woods, and what I'm wondering is, can we use an agricultural permethrin to spray along the circumference of our lawn? We had used a commercial mosquito tick spray service once, but of course, we don't want to kill the helpful insects. So would just permethrin spray on the lawn be helpful?
for ticks.
Yes, but the point is, I think one application a year is sufficient. And my concern is, if you put it multiple times, you literally cause more of an upset. We see spider mites and, you know, some of those beneficial insects we talked about. If you knock them out, we call them outbreak or secondary pests. So because of the way ticks work, permethrin is, or something related to it. Most of the chemicals we use come from the same family of insecticides now, at least the chemicals we use in the home garden, all have about the same effect, same toxicity. They're really not overly toxic to birds and people. They're really quite toxic to fish. And so there, if you read the label, there usually are some cautions about keeping the stuff out of water. But again, my advice would be, I wouldn't even spray the lawn as much as you said, that interface, the last 2 feet of where I mow and where things get more shrubby and brushy, because that's where the ticks are going to be doing the best anyway. And because ticks have a 2-year life cycle, you don't need to spray repeatedly multiple times a year. You spray once, and you should get the knockdown you need that will easily take you into the next year. I would think early April is a little too early, but usually if you can spray early before there's too much foliage so that you can get the spray more down towards the ground, because that's where the ticks are going to be hiding out anyway, that should be sufficient. And, yeah, the permethrin, the only thing is, technically speaking, the label has to allow the site where you use it. Most of the agricultural stuff, honestly, is used at the same dilution rate, often has a very broad label usage. So there'd be nothing wrong with that. But there are also, you go to the local hardware store or similar places, you will also find very similar products available, too, if you have to buy something different.
All right. EJ, thank you so much. Sylvia in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Sylvia.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a couple comments and then one question for Phil. For the gentleman that was asking about the white spider, it's possible it might be an Araneus trifolium, which is a shamrock spider. And I have pictures of several that have no pattern on. They're whitish. And for the gentleman that was getting bitten by unknown bugs, a few years ago at a butterfly survey, I had commented that I'd been in areas like Kettle Moraine and Horicon, and all of a sudden I'm getting all these bites, and three people prime in right away. Chiggers. Apparently they have been spreading in the state, and they will give you multiple bites and you can't find them. And also an incident recently, I had a ball-faced hornet building a nest by my garage door. I'm debating, I didn't want to kill her. I didn't want to spray her. Several days later, I'm thinking of what I could do, and I went and looked at it, and the whole thing was hollowed out. I'm feeding about 8 woodpeckers, and I have a feeling one of them got up there and cleaned it out for me. Phil, I have a question. Can you recommend a ID book on bees, especially for Wisconsin? I took dozens of pictures last year staying home with the COVID in my garden and a couple of other places, and I'd like to try and ID them.
I think you may have some luck doing an internet search, just bees of Wisconsin, because I've seen sites pop up. I mean, the other one that I would suspect would have some pretty good ID pictures is the Xerxes Society, which is, basically promoting now a lot on bees, but also butterflies. They promote the protection of various species and, trying to get people to understand. But there's been such an increased interest in solitary native bees in particular. So I have seen a lot of helpful guides on the internet rather than a particular book. Although there still might be one out there, but as I said, I've often relied. Another place you can always go to is a site called Bug Guide, which has incredible numbers of pictures. People submit pictures, they will identify stuff for you, but then they take the pictures that are identified and put it in a database. The only problem is they have millions of pictures, and so if you start and say, I want to identify a bug and go to Bug Guide, it'll be far too frustrating. If you know you've got a bee, at least that's a start, and you can go under the general section and see the things that kind of look like what you're talking about and then get into more specifics. So that would be another potential. The comment about chiggers, they are notorious for showing up a couple days after they get you. And as you say, the problem is they've already left. Chiggers are a species of mites that attack other insects in particular. And when they burrow into people, we're not a good place for them. But when they leave enough debris behind that the body reacts. And it's very classic to have chigger bites along confined parts of your clothing, along the belt line, the sock line, and the like. And one of the characteristics is for some people, it may be 2 or 3 weeks before that weeping and bite mark settles down. So they are very uncomfortable if you've ever run into them. And I tend to find more chiggers in kind of brushy raspberry type areas. That seems to be a habitat they like. In fact, sometimes even in people's raspberry patches, they have trouble when they go getting into chiggers. And so, it is a real stinker. And again, I don't know of anybody who's ever found the mite because, as they said, you're 2 days too late to find out what caused the problem.
Sylvia, thank you. Lee in Green Bay, hi.
Yeah, thanks. I'd like Phil to comment on basically the life cycle of our fireflies here in the state. I've got 20 acres, partially wooded, partially field. Is there anything I can do, through wintering them or whatever? Because I know they're active right now. And I'm just wondering kind of about the life cycle.
Yeah, so, the only thing that I see, as long as habitat is not changed drastically and it makes something a parking lot, you won't find fireflies there. The other thing is repeated use of mosquito sprays would upset things in the sense that would be very detrimental to their populations. But depending on the groups of fireflies we have, and we have a number of species, their larvae are predators that live in the soil, and they feed on things like slugs and millipedes and other things. So I will make a comment that because the things that firefly young feed on are influenced by moisture levels, excessive dry weather is not good for fireflies because the things that their immatures eat are sensitive to that. So what I'm saying is fireflies may be on a reduced number next year if this drought continues. But as far as is years, if you've got the right stuff and you have to have it for the fireflies you've got around, as I said, I would just kind of leave things be. They overwinter in the ground as immature stages. So there's nothing you can do for the adults. The adults are relatively short-lived. And, again, I've noticed fireflies in my backyard just starting about last 10 days or so, and I expect their numbers to continue to increase. And as I said, the neat thing is that there's more than one species, so you often, if you're in the right place, will have fireflies active for, 5, 6, 8 weeks.
Yeah, I've had them for about the last 2 weeks as well, and they're really beautiful, fun to watch, for sure. Lee, thank you.
And, of course, they are technically beetles. They're a soft wing beetle. Yeah. People often, I don't even know the exact derivation of firefly, but it probably has some European, since there are species of fireflies throughout the world, some European other language origin.
Thanks again, Lee. Tina lives in an 1890s house in Appleton. Emailed, she gets big, fat, fuzzy bumblebees in her basement. They get very slow in the basement, and she's able to trap them and put them outside. She can't find where they're coming in, but she's not sure what to look for. How can she discourage them from coming in?
Right. So I would pay most of my attention along the outside foundation, maybe not any higher than 10 to 18 inches up. If there's any place where the siding meets the foundation, there may be enough of a crack or a crevice that draws them in. Because bumblebees are, again, a ground nesting species. I would also pay any attention where you've got any vents or anything else coming out and make sure it's caulked. So if you physically tighten things up, and as I said, in an old house, there's lots of openings. But the nice thing about this is it's low. It's not like, for lady beetles and other things where we talk about up in the soffits and other places. I think these bumblebees are coming in the interface. They're looking for a nesting site, and then they just get confused. And, of course, once they get in the basement, they can't figure out how to get out.
Okay. Nancy and Nina emailed. She has a problem with silverfish in a kitchen cabinet. If It's a standalone cabinet, not near any source of water or dampness. There are no paper or bags or any kind of item like that in there, just several pots and pans. She cleans the cabinet often, but the silverfish keep reappearing.
I think they're coming from the walls. I had a home where, honestly, I found a species of silverfish I had never seen before. There's about three or four you can get in the state. And it turned out we had, the previous owner had put in a paper mesh insulation in the attic, and that's where the silverfish were happy to do very well in. And then they would spill into my living space, you know. And so, as I said, I wonder if the source is in the walls, and then they just work their way into that cabinet. You know, it's not worth tearing the walls apart. One of the things, I haven't seen this for a while, it was in catalogs, but it made some sense. Since silverfish are starch feeders to a degree, somebody had come out with a bait that was basically boric acid and starch, and they had them in these little sachets. So you could take that and stuff it in a place or hide it in a place so that the silverfish could get access to it. And again, as we talked about the ants, boric acid is a stomach poison. So if you can make an insect eat it, it will die. And so this mixture seemed to work. And that seemed to be, to me, a pretty reasonable way of putting something up that would help reduce the populations. You know, normally you talk about trying to dry things out, since many silverfish do need some kind of humidity. But whatever's going on in those walls, I just don't think it's going to be practical to change things that much. And again, it doesn't sound like they would be living and thriving in the cabinet per se, but they could definitely be continuing to migrate in from the closed wall. So, you know, getting after it from coming on the sill plate underneath or whatnot may be a way of trying to help reduce the numbers. The other thing is just look real closely in the cabinet to see, you know, are there screw holes or other things at the little stinkers, or maybe a seam that they could be coming through, and there may be a way of just tightening that up in a way to keep them out of the cabinet and be less of a problem.
Marin sent us a picture of a beautiful photo of an insect and wondered if you could identify it.
Okay, let me get back to my computer because I'm wandering around us. Oh, yes. This is a tanuchid moth. Now, tanuchid moths fly during the day. And there's a general rule that moths, of course, are night flyers. And often when you see moths that fly during the day, they're very brightly colored. And this comes from the fact that you know, moths typically find each other chemically, and so they don't need to be colorful. Day-flying things often use visual cues to find their mates, and so that's why many of the day-flying moths are brightly colored. And what you can't totally appreciate, if we could get this thing to spread its wings a little bit, the body itself is much like the thorax. It's a neat metallic blue. It's really, really a very attractive critter.
Well, Phil, on that note, we are out of time. Thank you so much for being with us. We'll look forward to your next visit on August 18th. Thank you, Phil.
Take care.
Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate. He'll be back. We'll be talking to the author of our second book club next week on Thursday, Jennifer Morales, and the book is called Meet Me Halfway. I finished it yesterday, and I really enjoyed it. It's available through UW Press. I hope you'll take a look at it. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.